Movie Bob Specialist Phil and John are back, and tonight we are on the fourth episode of our voyage, see what I did there, through the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and we are talking about Thor from 2011 and the Voyage of Demeter, as I found out it is pronounced, from this year, came out last weekend, and it's not Demeter, as I had kept saying, and that's how it was always read in my mind whenever I saw the
word. That was my logical way of saying it, too, until, you know, everyone started pronouncing it in that movie.
Well, then I wondered, like, is the movie just wrong? Like, maybe I'm right and the movie's wrong, you know?
Yeah, but everyone said it that way in the movie, so.
Maybe everybody in the movie's wrong. Everybody, maybe the guy who made the movie just didn't know how to say it, but we're here to talk about those.
We'll get to that one.
Yeah, we'll get there. But yeah, so we're here to talk about those. But before we get to that, John, I know there's like those weeks, there's those moments in your life where like something massive happens, you know, those really big occasions that you want to post on Instagram and do important things and let everybody know that you did it. I had that this week, and I finally finished all the Best Picture winners. Yes,
well, that's right. You did.
I finally finished all the Best Picture winners. Since we were last on here, I watched Grand Hotel and Kramer versus Kramer. Kramer versus Kramer was my final one, which I sort of started to do on purpose once I got to like my last seven or eight, because when I did the AFI 100 years, 100 movies, 10 year anniversary, the last one I watched was All the President's Men. I thought it was funny that Dustin Hoffman, who's like one of my favorite actors, his movie was the last one that I watched for the AFI Top 100. And now it's the last one I watched for Best Picture winners, at least as of now, because obviously there's going to be more. But yeah, finally finished them. I had set out on that journey quite a while ago. And Kramer versus Kramer was great. And Grand Hotel is much better than it has any business being, considering it is 90 years old. But it felt good to finally cross those off. And now I can just kind of keep going through other movies and stuff that I own and want to do. But yeah, it was really nice to finally say I've seen every Best Picture winner. And now when I sit here and say Coda sucks, I can say that so confidently. And it just brings me such joy when I say it's one of the worst Best Picture winners. In my opinion, it's the fifth worst of all time. So it just makes me feel so good to be able to say that. So what's up, John?
Not a whole lot. Your movie viewing has drastically increased in the last couple of weeks, and I'm just trying to keep up at this point.
Yeah, it's about to slow down.
You're watching far more movies than me.
Mine's about to slow down significantly. I'm going on vacation on Saturday, and then I get into the busiest part of my year. I work primarily in college athletics and pro athletics, and I have one more week of joy, and then it is going to be pure hell for 8 months. So I have to enjoy, like, this month. I think I'm up to like 25 or 26 movies, and it's August 14th. So that tells you about how I've been, but I had to start crossing them off, man. It felt good too. I rewatched all the Planet of the Apes movies. We didn't talk about it last week, but I watched Sot and Tango, which is actually Sot and Tango. That's really hard to say in our menial English minds, to say Sotin. Yes. And then Tango and not Satan Tango. It's got to be Satan Tango or Satan Tango, but Satan Tango is very hard to train my brain to say it that way, but that's actually how it's said.
Yeah. The accents don't help either, because we have the accents on all the A's in the title of the movie.
Except for in Tango. The one in Tango doesn't have the accent. That's why it's Tango.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
There you go.
It's also a Tango. That makes sense too.
Yeah, it is. It's 7 hours and 20 minutes long, and I watched that and didn't even mention it on this podcast last week, which is just pathetic. But all the Best Picture winners, John. I don't know if that's something you keep track of or if you have any have ever gotten to, but do you have a worst Best Picture winner before we jump into Thor, a movie that we totally disagree about?
I don't know. I honestly don't know how much, because I haven't seen any of the early Best Picture winners. And I haven't seen some of the ones that are like very often considered some of the worst.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I haven't seen like Out of Africa.
That was my worst. Out of all 95 plus Sunrise, that is my worst Best Picture winner. Worse than the Broadway Melody. And my review of the Broadway Melody still cracks me up to this day. If I can just share quickly. Is it bad that this actually surpassed my expectations? and it's one star. So it surpassed my expectations and I gave it one star. And it's still better, though, than Out of Africa. Out of Africa is horrible. But those are my bottom two.
No, I just haven't spent a lot of time dedicating myself to every Best Picture winner yet. So it's something I have to do eventually. But I can't think of what off the top of my head would be that worst one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a fun thing to do. And I'm excited for when we actually get to Oscar season now this year, because I've seen so many. I just watched Kiss of the Spider Woman, which is William Hurt won Best Actor for. And it's fun because I feel like I'm starting to really see a lot more of like the big five awards or big six awards, whatever you want to call it, director in there too. But director is so much harder to track because like what makes great directing for certain types of movies, right? Like David Dean's always going to be more iconic than like Robert Benton, who did Kramer versus Kramer, but like his direction in Kramer versus Kramer is great. So I don't know how to rank direction, but I sure know how to rank people who put their faces out there for my entertainment. So it's been fun to kind of go through that though. And I'm excited for when we get to Best Picture time, because now I can confidently say like what ones I actually think are overrated and what ones I think are far, far underrated. And it's funny, like a movie like The English Patient, which always gets hated on, and is a movie I actually quite enjoy. When the Best Picture winner rankings were all said and done, I have it at number 63 out of 96. And really what that proved to me is I like a lot of Best Picture winners. There's very few I don't like. The Oscars rarely pick a bad movie to win Best Picture. They just also very rarely pick the right movie to win Best Picture. And that's
they like appeasing people. We've talked about it before on our Oscar podcast, that they like picking the movie that most people are okay with.
Yep. Well, Let's talk about Thor, though. I just wanted to get that in there because it made me feel good. Let's talk about Thor. I actually came to the realization as I was watching it this time, I have never seen Thor. I thought I had seen Thor. I had never seen Thor. I had seen enough parts of it, I guess, when it had come out in 2011. I knew Natalie Portman was in it, and I knew that Stellan Skarsgård was in it, and I knew the girl from Two Broke Girls was in it. Kat Dennings. I know what her name is. I just like to call her the girl from Two Broke Girls because that's what I think she used to refer to herself as. And Chris Hemsworth, Anthony Hopkins. Who plays Anthony Hopkins' wife?
I have no idea.
Isn't it Michelle? Is it Michelle? I'm going to say something stupid. I got to look now because I want to be dumb.
Well, quickly.
It's who is it? It is. Maybe it's nobody famous. I thought it was somebody more famous.
It's Rene Russo.
Rene Russo, that's who it is. Yeah, so somebody who's like not that famous but was big at one time. So Thor, I was excited to watch this one because Loki is very entertaining. Man, I didn't really like this movie. And I'm really, really, really concerned based on the fact that I gave this 2.5 stars and on the fact that I gave Iron Man 2 2.5 stars. And I know how much I hated the Avengers the first time. I'm really scared for phase two. Like, I'm very scared. If I was this indifferent about Thor, this was so, like, between this and Iron Man 2, they were both so close to being 2-star movies, and I ultimately gave them 2.5, because what was I expecting? Not really much. But I'm really concerned for my phase two viewing experience when that comes.
Yeah, I can't defend phase two. We're just going to have to deal with it when we get there. But, like, I was actually kind of surprised you were so low on this one, in all honesty. And I get the reasons why. But to me, this is like easily top five, if not top three MCU.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, my God.
For me personally. And I understand that a lot of that comes from the fact that I'm a Shakespeare nerd. And this is a Shakespearean play with superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
And like, it comes off that way. It's directed that way by Kenneth Branagh. Oh, man, this guy who's known for being a Shakespearean actor directs this movie as a Shakespearean play. It doesn't have a, like, three-act story structure that we're used to. It has the five-act Shakespearean story structure. It's presented in a way where it's a lot of fun. I enjoy the dynamics of these characters. I enjoy looking at these characters and seeing what type of character traits from Shakespearean plays we're harking back on. It's not a Shakespearean tragedy because not everyone dies. It's not really a Shakespearean comedy at the same time, which can leave it in a little sense of like, okay, what's this movie trying to do? But I enjoy this. And Yeah, it's always been one of my favorite MCU movies.
Yeah, I mean, look, this could still end up in my top three MCU movies, dude. I don't have very high expectations for what's to come. So this could still end up in my top three. Right now, I have it at number two out of the first four. So that speaks volumes. But I guess what really got me with this movie is the spectacle of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not good. Like, I really was surprised. The CGI doesn't hold up. The battle in New Mexico with the giant robot thing, I thought looked atrocious. And I almost thought it was like, it looked too plain and was boring. Like, there was nothing going on in that scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, you know, I love the show Rome. I love that Ray Stevenson got more work. He just passed away this past year. So those are, I'm going to say those things now. Oh my God. Thor's friends suck. I hated Thor's friends every minute that they were on screen. And this goes into my, this is like my biggest complaint with these types of movies. And this is just why, like, this doesn't, these things just don't work for me.
Mm-hmm.
I hate that really corny, really cheesy, like, we're buddy old pals and we're going to do this. And like, it's so caricature, cartoony, whatever you want to call it. I hate that trope. I hate it in everything. It doesn't matter what it's in. I hate it in everything. And in this one, it's just, they are such cartoons. And like, doesn't the guy get like stabbed by the ice thing at the beginning? Doesn't the ice shoot up and like stab him? The one friend?
Yes.
It is never referenced again the entire rest of the movie.
Because he's fine. He's fine.
He's just 100% fine. Like 100% fine. They never, you never see him heal. You never see, I thought like, okay, he's going to die. Like, that's a nice touch. There's a character we don't care about, but that's nice. They never mention it again.
Yeah, because he's a background character. Again, like, we go into the Shakespeare of it all, right? Like, these are like your Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. These are your, like, the players.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's your bit players in it. And, like, you have to have them because it kind of shows the relationships of your main characters and, like, what they're going for. But they are there strictly to be, like, that cartoony character. They're not supposed to feel like a real character because they're kind of just like flushing out the cast.
Yeah, I get that. And I guess in these movies, there's so many characters anyway. Like, and recognizable actors playing these parts. I mean, this is Natalie Portman coming off of the Oscar for Black Swan. Stellan Skarsgård was always a face everybody knew. I think this was right after Mamma Mia. Kat Dennings, like I joked, like she's, I think by this point she was already in Two Broke Girls. I think it had already started up. You have Clark Gregg, who now we've seen in all the previous movies. You have Anthony Hopkins. You have Rene Russo, whose name I couldn't remember, but is in things. You have Idris Elba, who I know at the time wasn't really a household name by any means, but like you have
him. This is post The Wire. Like, he's a household name at this point.
Well, I think, but I will say this. I think The Wire has aged, has grown in the pop culture. It's kind of like Gene Dillman, where like nobody was talking about Gene Dillman like more than like 4 years ago. And now all of a sudden it's number one movie of all time on BFI's list or whatever it was, or Sight and Sound. I feel like that's kind of The Wire, where The Wire like wasn't as viewed when it was out. So I think Idris Elba, like, for sure. But I think Idris Elba at this point, like, my mom would know who Idris Elba is, and she's never watched The Wire. Tom Hiddleston, like, you have a lot of great characters. You have a lot of worlds going on because you have Asgard. I don't know how you actually say it. So that one, you have the ice world, and then you have real world. There's so much going on. I don't need to spend time with like these three jabronis just sprinting around being fools, you know? I'm sorry. I did, like, and I get it, but I just don't need it.
But again, like, I think they're the importance of these characters aren't, it's to have that realization that, oh, Loki must have planned this. Mm-hmm. And then to be the ones who realize, oh, Loki's king now. What do we do?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, again, it's this side character that's so common in a Shakespeare play that is just there for plot convenience.
Mm-hmm. That is
you
true.
You know, it's like how, you know, the pirates in Hamlet just are there to get Hamlet back to Denmark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I get it. And like, when you look at it from that perspective, cool. I get what Kenneth Branagh is trying to do with it. I mean, it is definitely unique from the other Marvel movies that I've watched so far. It doesn't necessarily mean I think it's better, but it is unique. I think my biggest problem with it, though, after everything, is just it felt to me like so unfocused. And I think the biggest problem with like this movie and Iron Man 2 compared to the first Iron Man, and we talked about it a lot with Iron Man 2, it just felt like it wanted to tell too many parts of the story. And it wanted to introduce you to Asgard. It wanted to introduce you to Thor. It wanted to introduce you to Loki. It wanted to introduce you to the ice people, whose names I really don't remember. Like, it wanted to introduce you to all of this stuff.
Yeah.
And I get how it becomes important for the rest of, like, the universe. But this movie, like, and I thank you, Kenneth Branagh. This movie's 2 hours long. Mm-hmm. They jam a lot in a very short amount of time. And I think it's to the detriment. I'm not, I am so thankful it's not a 2.5 hour movie, because I think the Marvel movies get ridiculous with their length. I mean, Black Panther felt like it was, it was 3 or 4 days of my life, but I do think like there was so much of like, boom, 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 boom. And it almost felt like it wanted to be, and I said this to my wife while we were at the end of it, it felt like it wanted to be a Lord of the Rings movie for a period there. Where at the end, even like the way that the friends are drinking is very end of Return of the King with Sam and Merry and Pippin all at the bar after Frodo is gone. And like, they're having a good time. We see that with the friends. And it almost felt like they just didn't have enough time to spend at the Shire, which was Asgard. They didn't have enough time to spend at Earth, which would have been your like going to Rivendell and all of that. And they didn't have enough time to spend at the Dark Place, which would have been your last hour, third act. And I just felt like it was very, it felt scattered, and it made it hard for me to care about
it's really interesting
anything.
It's so interesting you say that, because I don't feel that way at all. I feel like, especially in comparison to Iron Man 2, this story feels more direct. We're getting two storylines throughout the entire thing. We get Thor's storyline and we get Loki's storyline, right? And yes, there is this intermingling with Jotunheim and the Frost Giants and things like that, right? And we get, you know, Loki finding out he's a Frost Giant. He's actually, like, King Laffy's son, played by Colin Fjord, by the way. So, like, another, like, fantastic actor in this.
Who is Colin Fjord?
Colin Fjord. Well, he's Canadian, so you probably don't know
him. Okay. Oh, I've seen him. I just looked up his
picture. Yes, you've seen him. You definitely know Colin Fjord.
Yeah.
You just, like, might not recognize him off the bat, but and then we have like this dichotomy between the fallen sun and the rising sun in Thor and Loki, and how like their ties are changing and their lives are intertwined. And yes, they're two separate storylines, but they're so connected to each other because Loki is directly responsible for what's happening to Thor.
Yeah, right? No, and yeah, I agree. Yep. Sorry, if you want to keep going, keep going.
And it's just like the fact that like, I also think like it's so smart having this in the four act structure, because normally in all the Marvel movies we have seen before, the battle Thor has with the Destroyer is the end of the movie.
Yeah. Yep.
And this time we have this adversary who, first off, is so different from our hero. Which is so nice, because I was complaining about it last week, where we see these Marvel villains who are just the hero's powers, but different. Loki is the exact opposite of Thor. Loki is a conniving trickster who uses his mind to manipulate people, and Thor is like just like a Rock'em Sock'em robot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Swing a hammer, hit things, right?
Yep.
And because we have that difference, and we get this more of an emotional beat when like Thor realizes he's been betrayed by Loki, and we realize that like what Odin was doing by sending Thor to Midgard was making him worthy again, teaching him a lesson, right? Mm-hmm. And there's just these little parts in this movie that feel so much more complete than something like Iron Man 2.
Yeah, I get that. I get that for sure. Loki's also kind of like unfair. Tom Hiddleston is phenomenal as Loki, and Loki is actually like a really good villain. You know, that's the one thing that really the MCU has going for it, is that Loki kind of drags himself through the entire thing because he is a phenomenal villain and there's actual depth to him. Unlike any villain we've seen up to this point, the Jeff Bridges villain is fine in Iron Man. It's just very much it's just a very basic comic book villain, but he's fine. Yeah. Like there's no problem with it. Whiplash is boring and whatever. Tim Roth did his best. You know, he did his best. But Loki's a great villain. I mean, Loki's a complex character. He's a fun one to watch. I think him and Chris Hemsworth are fine. Yeah. I think it's everything supporting it that doesn't work for me in this movie.
Yeah.
And that's ultimately what hurts it, because first of all, I think the production looked terrible. I think it looks like atrocious. Like, I really do. Like, for the most part, I think it's
that just is so us looking through it like 12 years later, though, right?
Okay, go watch Lord of the Rings. It's 22 years old.
No, I understand. You will never not have me wanting practical effects over CGI.
Yeah.
At least this movie still uses real sets. Because let me tell you, Phil, yeah, we're getting to that point eventually.
I know. No, and so I guess for me, like, what it was I thought Hemsworth plays the role phenomenally. And, like, Hemsworth is great. I thought all the Thor on Earth stuff, when Thor is doing stuff, was fun. Like, all of his, like, slamming the glass on the ground and stuff. Like, that's little fun stuff. Natalie Portman and Stellan Skarsgård, I'm like, whatever. Like, they're doing something, sure. But I really like Thor, like, on Earth. I thought that Loki is a great villain. I thought that was great. But I don't care about the ice people. I like that, like, it's helping Loki's story flesh out, but I don't care about that. I don't think any of it looks particularly good. And everything that wasn't Loki and wasn't Thor, which actually is a large part of this movie, which I was surprised at. Even though they're the two main stories, there's a lot of stuff with, like, Natalie Portman and Stellan Skarsgård. There's a lot of stuff with the friends. There's a lot of stuff with just, like, Anthony Hopkins kind of dying and Idris Elba kind of like, I'm going to open this, I'm going to close this, whatever. There's a lot going on. Mm-hmm. I just don't find all that interesting. And then it's backed up by the fact that I was playing, like, Horizon Zero Dawn, like, 2 days ago, and it looks a million times better. And I understand that this movie's 12 years old now, but God, this looks like a video game every time they're not on Earth.
Well, there's the problem. You're playing the wrong video game. You had to have been playing God of War, because you would have remembered that Jotunheim and the Frost Giants exist if you were immersing yourself more in Norse mythology. But I actually think Natalie Portman and, like, I think the characters of Jane Foster and Stellan Skarsgård's character are so important to this story, because we're still at a point where Marvel's not really willing not to have the romantic co-lead. Mm-hmm. So, like, I understand the Jane Foster. Don't worry, we get to talk about Jane Foster a lot later.
Is it always Natalie Portman too? Does she stay as the character?
Natalie Portman is the only person to play. And like you said, this is Natalie Portman coming off Black Swan. I think Natalie Portman's great in this movie, because I think, but she kind of, like, she's kind of going back to that, like, Garden State manic pixie dream girl ish in here.
Yeah. But I don't know why she's in love with Thor other than that he's got muscles. Yeah.
I actually think it's because he's an alien more than anything, which is also, like, why I think those two characters are so important, because the MCU could have taken so many different directions with this movie with how to introduce Thor as a character again. We're clear where they're going at this point, but Thor is kind of like this magical being when we're talking about, like, a lot of science things, right? And the Marvel comics in general really focuses on science as a good and a bad thing. If we look at all of their characters, it's all derived from science. But Thor is kind of this outlier originally, because he's just a Norse god. But they take the scientific approach to it in this movie. They explain, you know, the Einstein-Rosen bridge, right, as, like, a wormhole and everything. They give us the scientific explanations for what's happening. And rather than this being, well, you know, Asgard's just this alternate dimension, Asgard is a planet somewhere where these characters are living on. They are just aliens.
Yeah, which is kind of, like, interesting. I guess the interesting part about the Avengers is that they all are quite different from the standpoint of, like, Iron Man's just a rich guy who builds himself a suit. But Captain America is, like, the only one who's really, like, recruited. And, you know, he's, like, the military guy, or, you know, whatever the word, not recruited, but you know what I mean.
You'll figure Thor, it out next after we watch
Thor,
Captain America.
Yeah, Thor's a god. And then the Hulk is just like, oh, I was part of an experiment gone wrong. And, like, I haven't seen Captain America since it came out. But, like, they all do have at least, like, somewhat of different backgrounds. And you're probably right. Like, she's into him because of that. But it does feel like it is very much like a Zach Braff Force storyline. For sure. Like,
it's actually funny because I just watched that episode of Futurama too, and you're very right.
Yeah. Like, it's a very Zach Braff forced love interest. And it's also like, it's like one of those where I'm like, I don't know. Like, it's just like the superhero love stories. I'm like, okay, sure, whatever. Go ahead, whatever.
It's so weird, but like, I think there's an importance to having the love interest in these movies because connections are really important to heroes. Heroes have to have connections. And it's kind of why like the MCU feels a little off right now, because we kind of went away with Secret Identities with Tony saying, I'm Iron Man, right? Because of that, connections, one of the big things in all of like comics is the fact that like the villains can't know who your identity is, so they can't hurt the people close to you.
Yeah.
But you have to establish who the people who are close to you before the villains go and like attack them, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what we're seeing in these building blocks in the MCU, right?
Yeah.
Where we have these building blocks and we have to build these relationships up so that there is something for a villain to attack later, maybe, maybe not. But like, there has to be stakes in what these people are doing. And when you have a character who is literally a god, his stakes have to be someone mortal.
Yeah. Well, and I do respect that, because I get why they have to be there. It's giving the motivations. It's giving like your interests and all that. Like, I do understand that, and I do appreciate that. I just think like I think about with what Christopher Nolan did with Batman Begins, Dark Knight, with Rachel.
Yeah.
It's childhood friend. It's more than just like a physical relationship, right? Which I feel like in a lot of these movies, like, I get like Tony Stark and Pepper Potts is supposed to be different, but also it's like, he's such a, you know, a dick the whole time that it's like, I don't really care. Like, I don't really know what he feels. And like, she, you know, like I said, in Iron Man 2, which is like, you really were almost dying. Like, that's one of the worst scenes ever. And then in The Incredible Hulk, I still don't even like Liv Tyler with a face doing something. I do feel like sometimes they throw it in because it's like, well, of course you're going to be in love with Natalie Portman. She's really hot. And it's funny that we watch this. Not funny. I guess it's not funny. I don't know. Maybe it is funny. We're actors and actresses put themselves out there, but we're watching this the week after like Natalie Portman's divorce goes through. And there's just meme after meme of like, what is this guy thinking, getting divorced or cheating on Natalie Portman? And so like, I do feel like sometimes they just take somebody who's really good looking and they're like, okay, now these two really good looking characters are just going to get together. And you know what? I kind of almost wish that there would have been a scene, because I always complain about stuff being too on the nose, but I almost wish there would have been a scene where she would have just looked at Stellan Skarsgård and been like, he's an alien. And like, I want to sleep with him because he's an alien. Like, I almost would have appreciated that.
I don't know if we actually got to the point where I felt like she wanted to sleep with him though. Right. Like,
they're making out pretty hard at the end of that movie.
I mean, yeah, fair. Chris Hemsworth is an attractive man, like, whatever. You know, hot people got to be hot people sometimes, right?
I'm just saying.
I know. But I think, like, I think it is that actual curiosity about, you know, this thing she's been studying her entire life. Now, all of a sudden, there is someone who can answer it. Right? Like, it's that curiosity. And I think that's why Jane Foster is, like, a little better than some of the female characters we do get in these movies. And, like, some of these, like, ancillary characters we get in some of these movies. Because there's at least some logical motivation behind how she's approaching this.
Yeah. No, I agree. Now, so I guess now that we're actually starting to get kind of into these, and I am about to start, like I said, I thought I watched this one. I hadn't watched this one. So pretty much the only ones I actually saw in their entirety when they came out the first time were Iron Man, Iron Man 2, Captain America, and the Avengers. And then I stopped. Mm-hmm. And I watched Black Panther because it was a Best Picture nominee, but that was it. I am very curious how we start moving through this, like what's actually important, what's relevant, blah, blah, blah. In the grand scheme, out of the first four, is Iron Man kind of the most important to the huge overarching story, and then Thor is second? Or is Thor actually more important than Iron Man?
Thor is the most important, in my opinion.
Okay.
Because it's introducing us to Cosmic Marvel, which is huge. Mm-hmm. Right? We're introduced to the space of it all. We are introduced to Loki, who's like this recurring villain who comes back. We are introduced to Thor, who is one of the members of the Avengers. We're also introduced to
Hawkeye.
I mean, something that I complained about in Iron Man 2 was like Scarlett Johansson's Natasha, right? And how there's this entire storyline. What a better introduction to an Avenger in this movie. Just like a brief cameo, that's what this should be, sets it up. Everyone who knows exactly who he is. When he returns in the Avengers, everyone's like, oh, that's that guy from Thor.
Yeah.
Right? It's all you need to set up a character like that. And it's just handled so much better. But like, I think with that, the big thing is just like the cosmic element of it all, especially with where it seems phase 5 is going. The cosmic element so important. So I think Thor is way bigger than Iron Man in the grand scheme of things.
Now, which one's characters actually bounce around the most? And when I say characters, I don't like throw out Nick Fury. That doesn't matter. And we know Hawkeye and Black Widow are both going to come back. But I mean, like in terms of like Pepper Potts, Jane Foster. Is there anybody else in Iron Man? Who else? Like, his name? Don Cheadle's character. Like, which one actually has like the most
important? Don Cheadle's character, like Rhodey, comes up a lot, especially in like the TV shows. He's come up a lot.
Yeah, but John, those don't exist.
I know. Well, don't worry. We'll have to eventually talk about like what they've done in those, because they're actually like kind of pivotal to some things happening.
Never going to mention them. Yeah, you can tell me. I will never, ever, ever turn those on. That is where I draw the line.
But Don Cheadle has been very important in Phase 4 and Phase 5. Rhodey has been. Pepper, Happy is actually John Favreau's character is in all the Spider-Man movies.
Okay.
So character wise, the people in the most movies are still from the Iron Man movie.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, yeah, I just wonder with these, like, because obviously as we're going to go through this, you're going to know the trajectory a lot better than I'm going to know the trajectory. So I just wonder like what's actually relevant, what's important, like what's really a standalone, because I always say if a movie can't stand alone on its own, then it's not a great movie. Like, look, like Empire Strikes Back is great because Star Wars exists and it's a continuation of that story. But I can also just sit down and watch The Empire Strikes Back without watching the first Star Wars. Now I have to watch the first Star Wars to get the story, but I can sit down and just watch The Empire Strikes Back and be like, yeah, this is a good movie. Like, I do wonder sometimes, like, I'm wondering as we go through these movies, how many of them are actually like good and how many do people say, oh, that one's good because it has the first introduction of said character that's then in a bunch of movies.
It's a great question. And it's one of those weird things, like, especially visiting this universe so far into it now too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, because like I agree with you, the Hawkeye intro is a billion times better than the Black Widow one. Honestly, because he's a smaller character. Like Black Widow was just too big of a damn character in the movie. She had no business being in the movie as long as she is. She takes over too much of the storyline for no real apparent reason. Whereas Hawkeye just kind of shows up. We know he's going to kill him. If he's given the chance, he could kill him. He could hurt him, whatever he needs to do. And so he does nothing.
And we get a lot of character in that introduction too, right? Like we get him like reaching for the gun, he grabs the bow instead. It's like, oh yeah, it's Hawkeye for like the hardcore Marvel fans and everything. And then you have like the, what do you want me to do? Do you want me to take him down? Because I'm beginning to root for this guy. Like we start seeing the character, and it's just like small lines. We see how he reacts to the situation, and that's all we need to know about him. And it's great.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. And we don't need to know like why he's working for these people, what he's doing. Like I said, like in Iron Man 2, it's a huge missed opportunity that she has nothing to do with the villain who's Russian.
Yeah.
When one of her defining traits is that she's Russian. Like, I don't know. I mean, I didn't hate Thor. Like a 2.5 star.
Yeah.
It's a movie it's
a good Marvel movie for you.
If it's on TV, I'll watch it. Like for bits and pieces, but I'm never going to go out of my way to turn it on. But like I had this last night, we were looking to watch a movie and my wife was like, you want to watch the next James Bond? And now that I'm through Moonraker and For Your Eyes Only and Octopussy's my next one. And then I have A View to a Kill. I have A View to a Kill first. And I was like, honestly, no, I can't watch one. Like I need to watch something else. Like I need to give myself a break from the bad last four Roger Moore movies. like Thor isn't like that, where if it was like, oh, we're watching these in order, we're coming up to Thor, I'd watch it. Like, no problem.
Yeah.
I just think it's one of those where there's like a lot of missed opportunities. It's a good popcorn movie, but it's a movie that ultimately, like, if I was back in college and it was on TNT and we were drinking in pregame, and I'd probably talk over most of it and be totally fine with that as we're drinking. And I'm like, yeah. Oh, there it is. Oh, that, there's that. Okay. Whatever. Like, I don't feel like there's anything like, I guess it's always like what I struggle with these Marvel movies, when people start talking about, oh, it should get Oscar nominations, and you know, Angela Bassett should win an Oscar for supporting actress over Carrie Condon. And like, I just like say to myself, I'm like, there's no real artistic merit to most of these movies. They're entertaining.
Yeah.
And you can, maybe there is, I mean, to you, maybe you find Thor to be artistic, you know, artistic, because you're finding the Shakespeare comparisons and things like that. But
right. But I'm just a big Shakespeare nerd, and that's specifically because of the director, right? Like, it's so specific.
That is true.
In this case, like,
and just go watch Shakespeare in Love, John, because it's so much better, even though you're wrong.
I know. I just find like this, I find Thor just has like the most compelling cast overall. Okay. Of these, like, especially these first like few movies that we've watched already, mm-hmm. where it's like, I'm at least invested in all of these characters while I'm watching it. Yes, there are these throwaway characters, but again, because of like the Shakespeare of it all, it's fine, because you need throwaway characters to mm-hmm. progress the plot sometimes. I think this is the best cast of these like first phase Marvel movies by far. Mm-hmm. I think every cast, like, it's just kind of like, it's almost unfortunate that some of these like big people are in these like minor roles.
Yeah, but I think it's unfortunate, but also fortunate, because I think if they were too big, if they were huge roles, I don't think that they'd be able to get them back to keep playing the roles, mm-hmm. or they would want bigger parts. And I think with as big as these casts become, you don't need to be jamming. How are we going to find 45 minutes for Natalie Portman and 45 minutes for Jeremy Renner and 45 minutes for everybody in these movies are Oscar nominated people or Oscar people. Like, that's, you got to find it. And so you need some of them to just take on small baby sized roles. Like, so,
but I think the big thing with Thor, and it's something that I've always said about the MCU movies are better when they are a genre film that has superheroes, rather than a superhero film with genre tropes.
Yes, yes.
And Thor is that. Thor is a Shakespearean performance, and it also just happens to have superheroes. Now, it can't go like full Shakespeare, because like, really, this should probably be a Shakespeare tragedy and everyone should die at the end.
Yeah.
But they're building something much bigger than that, so they can't do it. But
I wish they would.
I know. But
if they would have just killed them all in the Avengers, it would have been over.
Yeah, but they didn't. And we get to keep going on. We get to keep going instead, Phil.
I know. I'm so excited. All right. Can we move along?
Yes, let's move along.
And we're not going to end up talking about this one for 30 minutes, everybody. But let's talk about the absolute disaster at the box office. That is the last voyage of the Demeter. This movie, me and John were trying to figure out, like, what movies do we do? And honestly, like, I was kind of excited for this one. I like these little, like, isolation horror slasher, kill them all off. It's entertaining. Same way kind of I was just talking with Thor. Like, is there artistic merit to this movie? Actually, I think there is a little bit. There, I think Andre Overdahl did a very good job with the direction in this movie. I think it's a shame that the screenplay was pretty much bad, but we'll talk about the movie. Both of us gave it 3 stars. This movie's budget was $45 million. It made $6 million.
That's actually really surprising, because my theater was full for this movie when I saw it.
I went and saw it Thursday night, 5 p.m. So the first showing they had in my theater. There were like 45, 50 people in there, which is pretty good on a Thursday night at 5 o'clock. And I live in like a smaller town in Florida where it is more of like 9-to-5 job kind of people. It's not like I live in a city where you're going to get those people who, oh, I work at night, so I'm going to go see this movie at 5 or whatever. Like, it is a much more like normal town vibe, where at 10 o'clock, it's very quiet around here. So like 5 o'clock, there was a bunch of people in there, and I was like, wow, this movie's actually going to do pretty well. I think the biggest problem with this, the reviews were not kind. They were not kind to this movie at all. And I don't necessarily think that it was fair. It ended up with a 51% on Rotten Tomatoes. It had gotten down all the way to like a 40. And then it went up to a 51, which is still better than Haunted Mansion and better than Meg 2. But who wins at the box office this week? Well, number one is Barbie and number two is Oppenheimer. I mean, they've been out for a month and these movies are still one and two because that's just what people care about. It's not Gran Turismo and Gran Turismo comes out this week, I guess. But it's nothing else. It's those movies. Those movies are the ones that are killing it right now at the box office. And there's just nothing that can be done about it. Like, they're just going to keep winning. This last weekend, Barbie, $33 million. In its fourth or fifth weekend, $33 million. Oppenheimer, an R-rated movie, $18.8 million in whatever weekend that's in. I guess this is their fourth weekend for each of them, right?
Yeah.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles in its second weekend, $15 million. The Meg in its second weekend, so $12 million. So Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles jumped the Meg. But Barbie and Oppenheimer have this staying power that we just haven't seen from movies. So Last Voyage of the Demeter is looking at it going, okay, there's nothing coming out this week. We're going to do fine. The problem is Barbie and Oppenheimer won't die. They will not go away. Yeah. And you look at Haunted Mansion in its second weekend made $5 million. I mean, that's the movie we talked about last week. It's terrible. This is a disaster for Disney. $76 million worldwide. That's horrible. And Demeter just had nowhere to go because of movies that have been out for a month. So... Mm-hmm. We both gave it 3 stars. It only has a 51% on Rotten Tomatoes. What was your – now that I just talked about box office numbers and people are like, dude, stop saying math. What was your takeaway from this movie overall?
This movie was a lot of fun. Like, that's just what it comes down to, is this was a fun movie. We went in like – and I really think this movie is one of those movies that really is the reason why we're doing this series right now. Mm-hmm. Because this is a movie that – I probably wouldn't have seen in theaters otherwise.
Yeah.
Would have like waited for a home release and watched it there. But like, this was really fun. And like you said, like the script wasn't great. Definitely had some shortcomings, but there were a lot of really good things to like about this movie. And I just went in with kind of like an open mind to it. The reviews had come out. They were bad. And it was like, oh no, is this going to be absolutely horrible? So maybe it lowered my expectations for it. But I also went in just expecting exactly what this movie ended up being.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that's the detriment of the movie, is that it didn't do anything surprising. But I guess that's also what I appreciated about it, is I went into this movie being like, I want to watch Dracula kill these people one by one. Mm-hmm. And then Dracula killed them one by one. And that's what I wanted. That's what I wanted. Like, if you're going into that movie expecting to see like high art, it just wasn't going to happen. Maybe you get really lucky. But that's like when I went and saw Nobody and I was like, okay, this will be like an entertaining action movie where like he like beats people up. And then I thought that movie was just incredibly well made. I thought the acting was phenomenal. I thought it was very tongue in cheek in like the best ways. And I ended up giving that a 4-star movie. Like, I love Nobody. It surpassed my expectations. But even if Nobody did the bare minimum, it's still a 3-star movie to me because it did exactly what I anticipated it doing when I sat down. Mm-hmm. And you know, I just talked about Thor. I gave Thor a worse rating than Last Voyage of the Demeter because Thor to me was a little too all over the place. It's like, just tell me the Thor story. Just give me Thor, give me Loki, let them battle it out. But when you're trying to set up a franchise, you can't do that, especially when your biggest villain in the franchise is in that movie. You can't have him die. You can't have any like real satisfaction.
Yeah.
Demeter just kept going and going, and they killed off one by one, and that's what I wanted. And the characters, there was really no depth. I mean, Corey Hawkins plays a great role. I mean, Corey Hawkins and Liam Cunningham are phenomenal as actors, but their characters aren't exactly anything special. Aisling Franchosi, who plays Anna, we're going to talk about Anna a lot.
Ooh.
She was fine, but I don't know why that character was in the movie. And pretty much like it was all just kind of fine. It was your basic action movie where the characters are very one-dimensional because they're all going to die, except for the two or three characters that last the longest. And there's a kid, so he's a kid. That makes him stand out. And it's not Alien. It's not The Thing. But it was, I mean, it was fun. I enjoyed it. I'd watch it again fun. For sure.
I mean, I'm someone who just, I recently watched all the Friday the 13th and all of the Nightmare on Elm Street movies. And like, this is kind of in the same vein as those, right? Like, it's a slasher movie. Your slasher just happens to be one of the most famous monsters of all time.
Yep.
And I do wish they did more with Dracula in this movie. I wish they did varied things. Like, one of my favorite things about like these slasher movies, I like the variety in kills, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this movie did not have a variety in kills. All the kills were kind of samey, but it was the lead up to the kills in this movie that really made me enjoy it, because it was a lot of like the lighting in this movie, surprisingly really good.
Oh, the production design was fantastic. Like, yeah. The technical standpoint, the technical side of this movie was incredibly well done.
Yeah. And like the lighting, it's just like, it's one of those movies where you're always looking to see where Dracula is. Mm-hmm. It's like, where is he? And then you think you see him, and then he's somewhere completely different. And it's great. Yeah. It's the type of like, it's not a scary movie, but it's the type of like little things that you're looking for in a movie to make it more enjoyable.
Yeah. Yeah. And I agree with you that the kills were very similar all throughout, but I did like that they all kind of built into each other a little bit, where like you have the first one just get killed and the next guy kind of turns into the, you know, the ghoul essentially. Yeah. Like he's been dead. And then the kid, we know it's starting to happen to him. And like, I like that they all kind of built into each other.
Yeah.
To me, so like this movie is very flawed too. Like, I think from a technical standpoint, it was great. I think Andre Overdahl did a great job directing it, and I'm very hit or miss on him. I thought Autopsy of Jane Doe was phenomenal. I thought Scary Stories Telling the Dark was a piece of shit. So I'm very hit or miss on Andre Overdahl. I thought his direction was great. I thought what the actors and what he did and what the production design and set designers did with the script they were given was really good, because the script they were given was not very good. The script they were given was very basic, but everything else around this was good. My biggest problem with the movie is that the whole Anna thing is just not explained in any way, shape, or form. And like, okay, she's getting blood transfusion, so she's still alive. Okay, but everybody else gets bit one freaking time and they start turning into a zombie overnight. She's in a box getting chewed and eaten. Like, okay, he's playing with this food a little bit, but like, why? Why was that not like more drawn out, established? Why wasn't there a twist to that where she was working with him because she was a vampire? Like, that's way better than her just setting off to sea and burning herself to death.
I honestly thought it was going to be one of Dracula's wives.
That's what I thought, man. The character was hoping.
Right? And then, like, there's a lot of established mythology when it comes to vampirism and things like that. And one of the things that we didn't see that would have, the smallest thing you could add to this movie to make it so that the Anna character is completely explained, the simple rule of the only way someone turns into a vampire is they also drink Dracula's blood.
Yeah.
Right? Very established in the Dracula mythology. Mm-hmm. Literally all you need to do is have that one scene. It explains everything. All of a sudden we know why Anna's not a vampire.
Yep. Yep, and they didn't do it.
Nope. But like you said, like, this is a very bare bones script. It's very basic. It is like a basic like slasher type thing. It doesn't play into the Dracula of it all enough, in my opinion.
Yeah, it almost had like a Descent feel to it with the monster in this, where it was very like mindless. Although I guess like Dracula was smart enough. He follows the guy out onto the lifeboat, kills him. By the way, this is a spoiler heavy podcast. This is like, I should have said that early, but this whole series is going to be spoiler heavy. So if you're not watching the movies that we're talking about, like, yikes, my bad, but like, sorry. But like, he's not suave, and we're used to seeing Dracula suave, right? Like, that's the big thing with Dracula. He's always kind of smarter. He's more sophisticated than other villains, all that. I'm not mad that he wasn't. I guess what I was most surprised at the decision of is that when we see him in London at the end of the movie, he still looks like a vampire bat. And I think it would have been cooler had they just like seen him and it was like a much more sophisticated man, and it was almost like he came to full being by eating all these people.
Well, that's kind of what I was hoping for too, was like, I was, when we first see Dracula and he's like this feral bat-like creature. Like, okay, I like this. But I wanted to see him kind of, like, go into that Dracula we know. Or at least, like, get a little more, like, Nosferatu-y going on.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Where, because, like, it kind of felt like that's where the creature design was definitely, Nosferatu. Like, based off Nosferatu. Like, by a lot. Yeah. Like,
oh, yeah.
So obviously. And I just wanted to see it progress, because, or like at least get to a point where Dracula's talking, right? Because he's supposed to be a talky villain.
Yeah.
And like he should be taunting these people at the end. When we get to this last night and it's this bloodbath because everyone can die now because Dracula doesn't need to keep it, you know, doesn't have to pace himself anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, like, great. Like, you know what? That's a logical conclusion as to why he hasn't killed everyone on the boat. That makes total sense.
Mm-hmm.
But like, give us more Dracula. Like, give us some of, like, the other Dracula mythology other than the bat aspect, right? Like, Dracula can turn into a mist. And, like, when that mist is crawling up over the boat towards the end of the movie, I was just like, oh, this is Dracula himself just as a mist coming. Mm-hmm. And he's just going to, like, start appearing behind them. We didn't get that. It just felt like the script was somebody was really excited to have this movie made.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who wrote it were not as excited. And they were just told, read this one chapter of Dracula and make it into a movie. Whereas this needed to be made by someone who really, really loves Dracula.
So, a little inside baseball here. This script has been around forever in Hollywood. This script has been around forever. And I think what probably ended up happening to the script, like, we're talking like 10 years. Like, this script has been around forever in Hollywood. I think the biggest problem is it probably got watered down by production companies over time, because when you get stuck in that kind of development hell and then your movie finally gets made, it's gone through rewrite after rewrite after rewrite after rewrite. And also, like, I actually don't know who wrote the script. Let me look. Oh, who wrote The Last Voyage of the Demeter? Whoever it was, Brahe Schuit Jr., who also did Season of the Witch back in 2011. So you figure if this script has been around for close to 10 years, maybe even longer, I don't know. Okay, that movie was 2011, and then, you know, he comes and he has this script and he's ready to go and whatever. You start to lose interest as the writer also. Right? Well, like, you kind of start to be like, I'm getting into the rest of my career. Do I really need to keep, like, I'm not worried about this one anymore.
And there's also a second writing credit on the movie, too, for Zach Olkowitz.
Yeah.
Who did Bullet Train. Who's a newer writer, right? Like, has only really had success recently. So,
and so what I would show bet,
how much this has moved around. Yeah.
Yeah. And what I would bet is if you actually look at it, Brahe Schuit has screen story. I would bet that this was almost entirely rewritten by Zach Olkowitz to get it producible. And who knows what this looks like compared to the original screenplay. So that's the inside baseball stuff that I kind of like to look at with movies like this, because this is a movie that was in development hell forever. And it finally gets made, but you're looking at this writer who wrote the original thing, who's barely even attached to it. And the guy who did write it only wrote Bullet Train. And great for Zach Olkowitz. I mean, you got this, but I don't know if Zach Olkowitz is exactly going to be a hot writer after this. Bullet Train was good, but now he's got a $6 million on a $45 million budget screenplay to his name. And I do wonder if potentially Brahe Schuit saw where this was going and said, no, I'm doing my own thing now, and I don't want to be as attached to that anymore. Not that he's really killing it with his movies right now, but he did a Sylvester Stallone movie for Prime Video back in 2022, so he's doing all right.
It's very interesting, because, like, I think there are aspects of this film, like, we've been talking about the entire time, there are aspects of this film that are really done really well. I don't think marketing was very good for this film at all. I know, like, obviously marketing for films is very difficult at the moment with all the strikes going on and everything, But even then, like, TV spots were, I mean, TV spots are things that you don't really see. Like, I didn't see this movie plastered over my YouTube ads or anything like that, right? Yeah. Like, it wasn't coming up as I was watching YouTube or anything like that. You're already dealing with a niche market with a horror movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a PG horror movie.
And it's
or like PG-13 or whatever.
Well, we have it. It was R here. It's very violent. Which will, yeah, R. Anything with blood will be R. That's why if you watch Christopher Nolan movies, he almost never shows blood.
Ah, okay. Well,
blood makes it R. But either way, also though, a horror movie that's not really scary.
And, yeah, it's not really scary. You're yeah, dealing it's with much more of an action character movie. That you're kind of like taking your turn on, and I could definitely see a bunch of people going to this movie and be like, this is a Dracula movie. It's like, that's not Dracula.
Yeah.
And just
disliking
it because of that, right? And like not looking at the movie overall. I also think like the reveal of this being Dracula could have been saved. Like, I think it's one of those things that you could have revealed in movie. And like, first off, okay, before I get into that aspect, I have to talk about the absolute worst part of this movie. And that is the beginning of it.
Well, that was just the producers being absolutely ridiculous. I mean, why are they telling us every second? We know what we're coming to watch. I get it. And if I didn't know, it's almost like when I sat down and watched Prey, the Predator movie. I didn't know it was a Predator movie. And I watched it, and all of a sudden I was like, an hour in, I'm like, holy crap, this is a Predator movie. That was fun for me. But other people who knew it wasn't like some like, why did they do that?
Yeah, because so anyone who hasn't seen this movie, the movie starts with them explaining that it's based off the captain's log chapter in Dracula. And that no one's, like, the boat washes ashore and no one's on it. Like, they just tell you the end of the movie at the beginning of this movie for no reason. And I was like, okay, that's kind of sour. Don't like where this is going. And then, luckily, the movie was a lot better than that opening makes it seem. But this Dracula reveal, at some point, like, I actually think it would have been better. We have that one character at the beginning of the movie, the deckhand who like sees the dragon box and like freaks out and leaves. That would have been so much better if he was on the boat.
Yeah,
like doesn't recognize the dragon or anything, but recognizes the name Dracula when Anna says it. Then Anna's character becomes important at that point.
Yeah, right? and I do think that this movie was running into a couple problems with that, right? Where it. Some of the suspense, see, and that's where I gave this movie more credit because I actually think it did a good job of keeping suspense, even though there really was none. Yeah. And the reason, like, it kept suspense through actions. I thought the scene where the kid was in the room with Dracula and they see Dracula for the first time was phenomenal, which Woody Norman, by the way, was the kid from Come On, Come On, the Joaquin Phoenix, Mike Mills movie. He's great. Like, the kid's great. Yeah. And so... like you have him in that scene with Dracula and that's where the stakes get elevated, right? As the other guy is standing out there and they're trying to fight with him. Like, I thought there was a really good ramping up of tension, but what the problem with this movie was you knew it was Dracula.
Yeah.
You already have an inherent expectation of what Dracula is. You know, everybody dies. Mm-hmm. And even though not everybody in this movie dies, you know that that's what's supposed to happen. You know, this ship is doomed.
Yeah.
So how do you keep suspense on a really tiny boat when we already know that it's Dracula and that we know what Dracula does, which is, you know, bite people and suck their blood and do all that and feast and blah, blah, blah. We already know all that. And we know how this ends. How do you keep that suspense? And
the only way you can do it is by making it so we don't know when each person is meeting their demise or how they're meeting their demise.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why that scene with the kid is probably the best scene in the entire movie.
Yeah, because I was not expecting that the kid to die.
Yeah.
It was really well done. I mean, it really was. And then when Liam Cunningham is screaming, he's still moving. You're like, all right, he's hallucinating. And then he was like, oh no, shit. Like, he's still moving. Like, that was good. I mean, that was really, really well done.
More fire. Like, Liam Cunningham has to stop being in movies or in anything. So the kids don't get catch fire.
I know. If somebody asks if your kid can be in a movie, make sure Liam Cunningham is not also in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I, like that stuff was good. I just think there was an inherent story problem from the moment this happened. And that's where, like, I thought the visuals on the Dracula bat were amazing. I thought that it was kind of fun to have it just be like a mindless alien kind of thing. Like, I'm just going to destroy. But imagine if they really did kind of go the route of Renfield Dracula, like the book, and we do get a more intelligent Dracula who is like, there's a stowaway on this boat.
Yeah.
And almost don't tell us right off the bat which one of these people is Dracula. Mm-hmm. And turn it into almost a Murder on the Orient Express kind of thing.
Like a whodunit type thing, yeah.
A whodunit of which one of them is actually Dracula. Because there's a way to pull that off. Mm-hmm. Where it's almost like the thing now. Where you have them all on the boat. We don't know how it's been established. It could be the captain. It could be anybody. And we don't actually see Dracula come out of the coffin, have them set sail on a very rainy, dark day where there is no sun, or they set sail right before the sun comes. Who cares? They're just institute a reason, right? The reason can come from Dracula. But to have that and make it, that's where you can create suspense. That's where you could have created intensity. And that's where Dracula then becomes interesting, because now one of these people is lying to everybody and is actually the reason that everybody's dying. And if you go the Renfield route, well, now there's somebody who's also helping Dracula make this happen. Yeah. That's really fun. And I think that this, the route they went was fine. I'm not surprised it was a route that made them $6 million and that ultimately has them with like a 51%. And a movie that we are calling fine and we're happy we watched, but also like, I don't need to revisit this all the time. If it's on, I'll watch it, but like, whatever. But they could have gone a much different route and really shown the intelligence and sophistication of Dracula and kept the audience in the dark, because we know the villain has to be the bat creature thing, because that's who we see as the villain. But if we get this same movie where we don't get somebody popping out of a coffin and we don't get a bat thing and we don't get any of that, and maybe we just get the girl stowaway and they start blaming it on the girl.
Mm-hmm.
All of that can happen. But now Dracula is one of the actual crewmates. I get it kind of defeats the purpose of Dracula, but this also didn't have him speaking or anything. So it kind of defeated the purpose of Dracula too.
Or have him like controlling them, right? Like, we know he has mind control powers and stuff like that, right? Like, again, this is Dracula. We know what he can do.
Yeah.
Right? Have him do something like that, where he like hypnotizes someone to be doing stuff for him. And then like that's sowing the distrust amongst the crew. It's, again, like the way the movie's executed is fine. It's fun. But there was a lot of potential that just wasn't met.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Absolutely agree. It just missed on a lot. And like, you know, this is like I was saying with Thor, it's like 2.5 or 2. This is like a 2.5 or 3. Ultimately, I gave it a 3 because I really was surprised by the actual visuals. I thought the visuals were great. But yeah, I don't know. Like, there was a lot of missed opportunities.
But I think this is like, it's almost a good lesson for people moving forward. Like, this is like public domain material that can be turned into a movie like this. And with us coming, like, when we do eventually come out of this writer's strike, you're going to see horror movies because they're cheap to make. You're going to see things based on public domain because they're also cheap to make, right? Yep. Like these are the types of things we're going to have. And this movie, like, The Last Voyage of the Demeter, is pushed in the right direction. It just doesn't go far enough. Yep. So hopefully people are willing to go far enough when we do get to that point where this is pretty much all we're seeing in the theaters.
Yeah, no, I agree. Like, keep going with these kinds of things. The problem is, with how bad this movie just did, you're not going to see a Dracula on a boat movie maybe for the rest of our lives, John.
It's unfortunate, because really, like, the premise, Dracula on a boat, is already enough that should bring people in.
Yeah, I know. It just, like you said, there was a marketing problem. It's the time of the year. Man, people just have not shut up about Barbie and Oppenheimer. I mean, Barbie.
Yeah, I think people did underestimate that.
Well, it was impossible to correctly estimate Barbie because, like, I enjoyed Barbie. I thought it was fine. Like, I really did. I liked it. I think it's about to get itself a Best Picture nomination because of the budget it has or because of the box office is now brought in. The run that Barbie is currently on could be the most impressive run at a box office in the history of film. I really believe that because the craziest part about Barbie making $1.187 billion at the box office right now.
That's so much money.
Worldwide, 1.187 is that it has been out the exact same amount of time as a movie that has made $648 million worldwide.
Yeah.
So these two movies went head to head, and you always knew Barbie was going to make more because it's PG-13. It's opposite, and it's not 3 hours long, and it's not a biopic. It's like a brand that people know. You always knew it was going to make more, but it made almost 1.2 million when another movie has made 650 million. Those two movies have made almost $2 billion.
Mm-hmm.
The highest grossing movie of all time, I believe, is at 2.7. Now I need to look this up. Yeah. All time. Where is it? Worldwide. All time worldwide is, so Avatar's 2.9. But remember, now at this point, Avatar's been re-released. It was released in 3D. That's not something either Barbie or Oppenheimer did. It was re-released before Avatar 2 came out. So it had a lot going for it. After that, so that's 2.9. And then the next highest is Avengers Endgame, 2.7, Avatar Way of Water, 2.3, Titanic, 2.2. Again, another movie that was re-released a bunch. Star Wars, 2 million. Avatar, Infinity War, 2 million. So, like, I just went down the line. Those are the top six. If you combine these two movies, they would be seventh all time.
Mm-hmm.
That's ridiculous. And that's what's so impressive about the fact that Barbie has still made $1.1 billion. Is that it is taking, like, Barbie right now is 25th all time in domestic box or in worldwide box office. Now, granted, like, I understand we're talking, like, not with inflation or, you know, this is just, it's not taking into account any of that. So that's still whatever. But Oppenheimer is at 163rd.
Yeah.
I mean, Oppenheimer is going to be top 150 all time.
Yep.
It's just wild. And yeah, these movies, these people just were not expecting the staying power. I mean, honestly, what Demeter people were probably thinking is, okay, Haunted Mansion comes out the week before us. That's fine. They'll be done with Haunted Mansion. Now they'll be in the horror mood. They'll go see Demeter. Instead, they didn't see either.
Yeah, because they're still seeing Barbie and Oppenheimer. I mean, like, it was like I was saying last week with Haunted Mansion, where Disney had this excuse with the writer's strike to push things back, and they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Sony did.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know, Sony pushed Gran Turismo back 2 weeks.
So when is Gran Turismo officially coming out then?
The 25th.
See, so Gran Turismo was supposed to be last week.
It was.
That's what I was confused about, because it was supposed to be last week. Yeah.
So Sony pushed it back 2 weeks because they saw what Barbie and Oppenheimer was going on. And they had the excuse of the writer's strike to push it back 2 weeks. So they did.
And they just did that because we almost did Gran Turismo as our movie, because when we were discussing it, it still was supposed to be released. That's crazy. Yeah. It makes a lot of sense, though, because guess what? In 2 weeks, Barbie and Oppenheimer aren't doing 20 million plus at the box office anymore.
No.
And there's nothing behind it. Haunted Mansion will be out. Demeter will be out. Ninja Turtles will be out. You're
competing with about, and that's about it.
Yeah. Wow. That's crazy. Yeah. I didn't realize it backed off.
Yeah.
Wow. Thanks, John. That's good to know. I mean, I didn't realize that.
Some people listen.
Some people listen. Yeah. Wow. That's a good move. That really was a good move.
It was a smart move. Smart move.
Yeah.
Sure. And unfortunately, Demeter didn't do that. Demeter instead but like a month out, you're not expecting this. You're not expecting these movies to still be the movies that people are going to. And like, we're looking at Barbie is a movie that has brought people back to movie theaters. There are people who are seeing this in theaters who have not seen a movie since COVID.
Yeah. And also, the thing with Demeter is it's a small budget. It's an independent film.
Yep.
So being that it's an independent film, there's it couldn't. It doesn't have that kind of pull to be like, oh, we'll just move back. They gotta pay people now. And really they're not gonna pay anybody. Yeah, crazy though. So Oppenheimer is the seventh highest grossing R-rated film of all time. Right now. I know. And Barbie is the 25th highest grossing film ever.
Yeah.
That's an incredible weekend that has now lasted a month and it has destroyed so many other movies. Anyway,
okay.
We're moving on.
What's coming next, Bill?
So we're not going to be here next week. I'm out. We'll be back on the 28th, the last Monday of August, and then we might shift around some dates here and there depending on the week. But we'll be doing August 28th, and so we're going to do Captain America, First Avenger, and we're going to be doing Strays because screw it. Why not? You want to talk about high art and you want to talk about cinema? We're going to do Strays.
Talking dogs.
We're going to talk about talking dogs. So we'll be doing Strays, which comes out this week, which is good because then I can watch it and go on vacation and not have to find a time to watch a movie that comes out next week. So we'll be doing Strays a little bit later, and then we will be doing Captain America, the First Avenger. So that'll be on August 28th, so 2 weeks from today. So we made it through four episodes. That'll be our fifth one. Hope you're all enjoying it. I know a lot of people were listening during Thor, and then once we started talking Last Voyage of Demeter, everybody turned it off probably because they haven't seen it. So why are you going to listen to us talk about it? But
no spoilers.
As we start getting into Oscar season and stuff like that, people will actually watch the movies. Barbie and Oppenheimer have just broken everything. So
yes,
we'll see. But all right, everybody. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.